Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the show where big voices meet even bigger results. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and today's episode isn't just another feel-good pep talk about growing your audience or finding your brand. Nope, we're going way deeper into the guts of the social media machine itself. We're talking shadow algorithms, dopamine-driven design, the performative nonsense that passes for authenticity online, and the one guy bold enough to call the whole thing out from the inside. If you've ever felt like social media is rigged, addictive, and quietly shaping how you think, post, and even speak, you're not wrong. And my guest today has the receipts. Tim O'Hearn is not your typical tech bro turned author. He's part code slinger, part digital dissenter, and he's made over $500,000 in what most would call a social media side hustle, while also calling BS on how it all works. Before that, he spent 8 years in quant finance, helped design the very things you now scroll and tap on: feeds, push notifications, recommendation engines. He's seen behind the curtain, and he helped build the curtain. He's also a number one best-selling author with his book Framed, A Villain's Perspective on Social Media, offering a no-holds-barred look at how we're all being manipulated by metrics, by AI, and by our own desire to be seen. Oh, and just for fun, he's a former NCAA runner, a top nonfiction reviewer on Goodreads, and a gonzo sports writer who knows how to turn insight into impact. Today, he's joining me to talk about what public speaking looks like in a world built on curated clicks, why most marketers are selling you fairy dust, and what it actually takes to grow a powerful voice without losing your soul in the process. Gotta tell you, welcoming you to the show, Tim, really excited about this conversation.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm so happy to be here.
This is gonna be awesome. And I think about it, quant finance, engineering, journalism, now an author and founder. What was the moment, if there was one, when you looked around and said, yeah, this isn't it, I need to do something different? I'm really curious.
It would probably be back in 2017 or 2018, working my first big job. You think, okay, I've made it. I graduated from college. I have my own apartment. I can pay my bills. And for many people, that's the ticket to a decent life. And for me, I realized I was in a new city. I had no friends. And as I left work every day, I still wanted to keep going. There was more I wanted to do. And eventually what this led to was becoming involved in the social media underworld, was joining a business where I helped build the systems that essentially exploited many things in the sociological sense, as well as specifically in the technology Instagram was using. So it was really my first 2 years out of college where I was working a full-time job, and I realized, you know what, I think I could do more. And that side hustle led to a really fun traversal through my 20s.
Love that. I was looking at your LinkedIn and it's like a choose your own adventure of intellect and grit. Like, you, what are the threads that connect all of those kind of seemingly unrelated chapters in your life?
I hold a very strong belief in the moral obligation toward productive labor. So for me, going through life, I realized, okay, probably I wasn't going to be a carpenter. But in my worldview, I still very much value those who maybe work in the trades, because for me, it's about thinking about what you're good at and how you can produce the most value and doing that for as much time as you can. And it doesn't mean that I don't enjoy leisure or travel or having fun, but it does mean that I'm someone who takes my hobbies very seriously. And I think the underpinning here, the theme, really is seriousness and realizing that I'm willing to push myself and I want to know, How good could I be, or what is the limit? So that goes for everything from athletic competition to writing to being an engineer, which is, you know, what I went to college for, to running businesses. And I've had different levels of success in different realms here, but I think it's the seriousness that underpins it all.
Well, it's interesting because you're really the epitome of that Will Rogers quote, find what you love to do and you never work a day in your life.
I think that's true. Sometimes it's been a drag or it's been stressful for sure. But what I found is that a lot of jobs do just feel like jobs. And that's why so many of us do pursue entrepreneurship, because we want to be responsible for the whole thing, from ideation to taking it through and then one day deciding to sell the business, close the business, and leaving it up to us to choose our next adventure.
I love that you're from another generation, and I love that you really epitomize what's exciting about the next generation. You have a different take on things. It's not just about working to death, especially in something that doesn't fulfill you, but it handles things, takes care of bills. You guys are a much more exciting group, and you have the better tools than we ever had. So I love talking about this. I love that you've designed the exact kinds of platforms, like social platforms, that are out there these days, but then you turned around and exposed them, which I really appreciate. How did that experience shift your understanding of the space? And share some of that with us now for the people that haven't had the chance to read your book yet, and we're going to cover that. I'd love to know how, you know, when you talk about the underbelly, you got to tell us more. Come on, a lot of us don't know a lot about that.
It's very interesting that I had the opportunity to be on both sides of this. And when we talk about both sides, we can think of any person who's on social media today or uses the internet today has definitely seen some bad behavior. And they've definitely seen some rule breaking. And one day, if someone says, hey, I'll give you $100 if you do this, or I'll give you $1,000 if you do that, most of us would have some idea of how it was done. There's a lot in between getting that money and thinking we have an idea. But the point is that in 2017, I was in a position where I was essentially offered like $500 to build out the payment system and other aspects of a website for a business that was breaking the rules on Instagram. So my introduction to this industry was not get people a bunch of fake followers. It was not create a bunch of spam. It was actually just to help the business take digital payments and help to support customer sign up. Pretty soon after that, we realized, okay, there's so much more for us to do here, which then involved me creating bots, essentially, or a botting program that got people more followers on Instagram, which we can talk more about in a moment. But then the other side of it was that after I had done this for about 2 years, I had some reputation, or at least I had a network of people who knew what I was good at and what my interests were and what the business was involved with doing. So I was getting a lot of interest just in consulting arrangements from saying, hey, you know how to scrape data, right? You know how this really works on social media, right? Is this fake? From very simple questions all the way up to like basically Fortune 500 companies through back channels getting to me. So eventually this led to a startup that was actually quite small, but had raised about $10 million, where they wanted me to come in and lead special projects, which involved building their internal social media feed, building their push notification infrastructure, and also building what we know as a recommendation engine. So meaning like when you five-star a couple movies on Netflix, how does Netflix know what movie to show you next? It was that same concept applied to their social network. So yeah, I've seen both sides of it.
I think this area is so fascinating right now. I'm fascinated as someone who wasn't a big, not that I'm not a big fan of social media. I'm a pretty private person, and that's really hard these days. You really have to be out there. And to hear what you're talking about is you really can't avoid it anymore. In order to be relevant, you have to be out there. But this is you showing us, what do you think? I have a question for you. You positioned yourself, you're the foil to social media and marketing pundits. What's the biggest lie being sold right now about social media success?
Everyone has something to sell. So in being the foil, it means that, sure, I have my book to sell, but I don't have a course, a five-step plan, a guidebook. Many people are selling things that revolve around beating the algorithm. It's actually very difficult for an outsider, someone who doesn't work on the algorithm as a software engineer, to tell you how to beat it. So I think that theme is the largest thing we see rehashed, and we've seen it rehashed for almost a decade now, where these brands and brands of influencers, at one point who all were older than me, and now who all are younger than me, are basically selling the same thing, which is you can get clout, you can get popularity, you can increase your sales if you do X, Y, and Z. They're all trying to sell you a course at the end of the day. And I find that anyone who pretends to have an idea of how the algorithms work might have an inkling, but nobody has the full playbook. And to be honest with you, even I don't.
Yet it sounds like they should come to you for a real answer on how to do this, on how to accomplish this.
Absolutely. And if you take some of the topics from my book and you just Google search them or you use AI to tell you about them, which I guess everyone does now, you'll just find yourself in this circular loop of half-truths and rumors. And a lot of the people who are claiming to be experts and who want to tell you what a shadow ban is have no idea, not only how it originated, but also how it's actually implemented on the technical sense. So from my perspective, I know pretty much where it originated. I know how most platforms roughly implement it. And I know some of the effects because some of my customers got shadow bans as well. So yes, I would love for more of those people to have contacted me when I was most active. And yes, I view many things, even in my LinkedIn feed, and just shake my head and say, where do I begin? It's not about leaving a comment on the LinkedIn post and saying you're wrong. It's basically just trying to reprint entire segments from my book and saying, this is why you're wrong, or this is what you need to read before you feign expertise.
So, do you feel that social media is an absolute essential? And is there any benefit to what people are doing now, posting on LinkedIn and creating a blog and posting on their YouTube channels? Is there value in it?
There is value, and an unfortunate consequence of the world we live in is that it is essential. If you have something to sell, and this includes LinkedIn, if you're trying to sell yourself as a candidate, if you have a company and you want people to work there, the way to get the best job or the way to get the best candidate is to have a great social media presence on LinkedIn, which is branded, in perhaps including like LinkedIn pictures and videos posted to LinkedIn. So, yeah, unfortunately, it's all very necessary, but it comes back to this truth in that I was never an expert at social media management. I was never an expert at creating content. Yet, if I wanted to sell 10 times as many copies of my book, all I had to do was build an Instagram presence and a TikTok presence, maybe hire somebody to help me with it. I would have sold 10 times as many copies. So that's something I wrestle with as well, which when I published Framed, I thought, you know what? There's so much I could do in the unsavory realm. There's so much I could do just because I have a fair amount of money I could also dispatch to game it, just like I gamed it, except in the new realm, to sell more books. And I didn't. I chose, you know what? I'm not even going to create a TikTok. I'm banned from Instagram. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to do Twitter. Pretty much all I've done is my newsletter for my website and just a string of podcast appearances. So yeah, it's an unfortunate thing now where many authors are finding that if you have the best book, if you've written the next great American novel, it turns out you also have to have one of the great American Instagram presences if you want to sell that many copies.
So to regular folks out there, I deal with a lot of authors out there, and I love entrepreneurs. That's my favorite group of people. I'm one, my family, we love the spirit of the entrepreneur. But what do you tell the person? Let's take the author, since you have so much expertise. What do they have to do if they're brand new and starting out? What is a good, successful method for them to maximize the opportunity of Instagram and not be wasting money or wasting time that isn't going to serve them? What would be your best advice for that?
It depends on the genre. So if you're writing fiction, it's one thing. For example, if I wrote a fiction book, we probably wouldn't be speaking on this podcast. Nonfiction is a little bit better because you should be able to provide value in some unique way, which lends itself more to like organic marketing and even keyword-based marketing, which is to say you might have to pay to run some ads. You might have to pay for this. I've had podcasts ask me to give them thousands of dollars to appear, but I'm not going to do that. So the point is that there are many marketing avenues, and even in the self-publishing space, I've written about it on my blog as well as my newsletter. Most of these things are a complete scam. And a lot of people have too much pride and they've put too much into their book where they think, okay, if I get this into the right person's hands, this will be it. And unfortunately, it just turns into $200 there, $500 there, $1,000 there. And the truth for most self-published authors is that what you're imagining simply does not exist due to the saturation of the market. It's incredibly saturated and standing out is pretty much impossible unless you're ready to put $20, maybe $30,000 behind the effort.
And of course, they've already spent that to do their book.
And it's really interesting that you bring this up because somebody forwarded to me the article in Bloomberg from yesterday, and it's about these gigantic scam operators in the Philippines that are fleecing authors out of tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the services I interacted with, I wasn't scammed out of thousands of dollars. I was saying paying more for an editorial review, which is a common practice, or for ad campaigns, or maybe some consultants for PR. But there are entire operations that are based around targeting people writing their first book and then stringing them along with saying, okay, if we get the ad here, then you'll get this. And if you get the ad here, we'll do this. And it's really predatory and I think unfortunate, especially for older generations.
I've watched that myself. I see what you're saying. I cannot believe. And a lot of times, this is where it just really hits me. You've got entrepreneurs that don't have a ton of money. They put everything into what they're doing. They've quit their jobs. They don't realize when they start off on an effort that no, it's going to take more than just you and your brains and your commitment and your efforts. You will need to include some other components in order to grow what you're doing. But then they get taken advantage of by people, and it's absolutely monstrous. It has been such a turn off situation to watch it. I really had to step back for a while because I'm just not going to participate in this stuff. I'm for a good coach. Let's face it. I love coaching, and I will tell you, there's not a great athlete in the world, really think about it, that hasn't done better because they've had a great coach. But even that's a very predatory business. I hate looking at it. It's hard to stomach.
Yeah, I think it's important to call out because a lot of people will be heads down in their book or in their effort, and 90% of their time is spent doing that. Then when they realize that they don't get 1,000 organic sales in the first week, they start Google searching. The top results in Google search tend to be quite predatory. And you can also find that so many authors are embarrassed that they're not being candid about the experiences that they've had. That's changing where there's more candid reviews. You can go on Reddit and more people are saying, hey, this is a scam, that's a scam, that's a scam. But it's really unfortunate in different businesses, not just authors, but like you said, some support services and also things like coaching.
So I really want for people out there that are writing that book, and a lot of them, you write that book, I don't know if you would agree, but it's not usually the money maker for you. It's not, you're not going to make a lot of money writing a book. It's really an authority builder. It's an opportunity to set yourself apart in whatever industry that you're in, but it's how you leverage that book that can benefit you after the fact. How do you feel about that? And I want people to be able to do some of this themselves without having to hire some marketing agency or go out and buy a bunch of ads, which doesn't really serve. What can they do for themselves? They can do it by themselves.
I think your first point is well said in that there's just a lot out there. And I think a lot of people who are writing their first book hopefully have laid everything out and have a good idea of, okay, here's how much I'll really make. Here's what it will mean to me as a professional or as an individual. And then maybe here's what it means to me personally as well. Like my book has memoir elements. So, of course, there was a personal thread there as well. I self-published Framed and I did it without much help. So I had an editor, but I did not have any help beyond that. Like I designed the cover, I did the formatting, and nobody did developmental editing. So my editor was only basically saying, okay, your words are clunky here. There was no connection, no assessment of concepts. And then for the promoting aspect, I'm like, okay, in the book, I claim to be this master promoter who did this, that, and the other thing. It must not be that hard. You then find out that it's a totally saturated industry where I'm not selling an Instagram growth service anymore. I'm selling a book about Instagram growth services. One of the ironic things I realized is that using keywords about topics in my books actually caused some of my ads to get blocked by different ad providers because it seems like I'm selling one of these unsavory services when actually they can't exactly understand that I've written a book about these services. So what people can do in publishing their first book, I think the first thing is to sit down and really think about what is going to come up of it and what, based on similar books in the niche, in the genre, what the outcomes actually were. That doesn't mean looking at the New York Times bestseller, but it might mean looking at the top five on the Amazon list. I looked at the top five on the Amazon list for a period of years, and I knew I could write a better book. Many people, readers, critics, sales figures, tend to agree that I did write a better book. For other people, it might not be that easy. My niche was actually not that crowded. For other people, if you're writing like a sports book, good luck, right? Like it depends on the niche as well. So yeah, I think that's important to talk about because a lot of people say they're doing self-publishing for one reason, but then they're kept up at night for another reason. And it's because secretly they did hope to become famous.
Interesting. Fame can really take you out. Framed, A Villain's Perspective on Social Media. What an interesting title. People will certainly pay attention to that. I know it caught my eye instantly. It's not just a title for you, it's really a call out, wouldn't you say?
It's definitely a call out, and there's layers to it. So calling it Framed is a reference to all of the other tech books that have come out, like Disrupted, Irresistible, Zucked. A lot of these books that are ending in like the ED type, like words that end in ED, but then also these references to aspects of technology. So a frame is like a picture frame, or like saying, hey, this is my framing of things, but it's also a commentary on those boxes that we see when we scroll through social media. And in the early internet, there were actual frames around content feeds. So just in the word framed, it's one thing. And then in the subtitle, saying a villain's perspective on social media, it is a call out because it's quite rare that somebody will self-identify as a villain. And that in and of itself is a conversation starter, where by the end of the book, people are wondering, is this guy really the villain? Or who is the evildoer here? And that's really what it was meant to stoke, is that larger conversation of, is the worst person in the Instagram growth industry actually all that bad? Or by putting it into words in the way I did, maybe I'm actually doing a service.
So cool. You really wrote a manifesto in villain's clothing. But I think that's so impressive. And if people read this book, can they benefit from this book if they aren't tech savvy or if they don't have the lingo down? Will it benefit them, or is it just for people who really understand or who can speak the speak?
Ultimately, the book is an essay collection in which the concepts don't really build as chapters go over and over. So there's no code samples, there's no confusing diagrams of the flow of how the internet works. Examples I could give would be like my parents are both in their 70s. Both of them read the book and both of them enjoyed it, hopefully beyond it being written by their son. A lot of the concepts are easy if you abstract them away and think, okay, this is a social network, or okay, I need to Google this. The technical depth is there, and it's definitely apparent compared to a mass market book, but it's totally accessible. And people have told me there's pretty much only one chapter in which it's too technical. Unfortunately, that's chapter five. So it happens pretty early in the book, but you have 25 other chapters where how tech savvy you are plays no role in your enjoyment of the book.
No, technically, I love this. I love that this is open to more people who are really going to get it sounds like a real sense of this. But who's the book really for? Who needs to read this book?
I would love to say everyone on the internet or anyone who uses social media. I definitely wrote it as an outgrowth of the conversations I would have with my friends or my coworkers at the bar. So it's all these things that you're thinking, man, like, how could it be this way? Like, Why does the algorithm know me so well? Why do I feel so tethered to my phone? A lot of these conversations that were being had over for me, basically for my 20s, and putting it into a book and saying, okay, I'm going to explain my thoughts on this, my involvement with that, what I know this guy did here, and to package it all up in a way that explains social media in a very unique way. So it's not every day that somebody logs into Amazon and says, give me a manifesto by an unknown author who has this to say about social media. But that is the audience. It's people who have some interest in tech, some interest in the social aspects of the internet, and also people who enjoy decent prose. So I think I've captured a lot of that in my book and have tried to make it accessible to a wide audience while being the perfect book for actually a quite select audience. That being people who were born in the 1990s and also grew up with the internet and also saw this crazy, chaotic world kind of start from nothing.
No, that you. I'm glad to hear this because I'm excited for everybody to get a chance to see this book. I understand there's a real tension in the writing of this book in that you're between understanding the system deeply and at the same time wanting to tear it down. Was it cathartic to put it out there in the world? Did you, or did it even make you feel even more of a sense of responsibility because you had this information?
Kelly, that's a great question. And I would have to say that catharsis was primary here in that I loved getting it all out there. And for me, so much of this was written not knowing if I would ever really make it to the finish line. So some of this, we're talking like 2020, even like 2022, when I really start rolling with this. I didn't have a publisher waiting for a deadline. I didn't have anyone asking for the manuscript. I just had to keep writing. And a lot of it was written in a way where earlier drafts were written under a pen name. I just wanted to get it out there. I didn't care if it was ever traced back to me. And I was worried about certain blowback. But yeah, that was pretty much how I would talk about it, in that I never felt like I had a true responsibility. But as time went on and I was sitting on this collection of essays, I realized nobody was going to write about it. And it bothered me. Not because I knew I needed to be the person, but because I felt like my friends who I'm interviewing now, they don't even remember what I'm talking about. If you Google MySpace, nobody knows what's going on. If you email the researchers who have written articles about MySpace, they say they forgot why they even wrote what they wrote. So to capture MySpace and the evolution of social media, which I do quite well in section one, and then to capture the very specific details of what happened in Instagram growth, starting from the founding of Instagram through about 2020, nobody's done it like that. So after a while, I did feel like I had a responsibility simply because nobody else had stepped up, nobody else had captured it, and nobody else was w willing to risk associating their name with it.
Wow, that's fascinating. Honestly, this is fascinating. The Instagram, are you pro Instagram or it sounds like you have a dual relationship with Instagram. Is it the best way to go these days in your mind?
I largely do not use social media, and I make that awkward admission in one of the final chapters of Framed. I haven't used Instagram in more than 5 years since
Oh
before
my
COVID,
gosh.
but
Really?
I was still running a business. So while my personal Instagram actually was banned, I don't remember, but I had certain accounts that I had to at least log in to see how things were going, but I wasn't like following my friends. I wasn't DMing people. I wasn't promoting anything there. So it's been like what feels like a lifetime off Instagram, where now friends will say things like, oh, I meant to tell you, yeah, we got engaged. And I'm like, okay, like that would have been nice news to have on some other platform. So is it the place to go? I think the answer from people I'm close with would be yes. And it's where people are making major life announcements. But for me, I've got along fine without it for 5 years, and that's while writing a book about it.
And they banned you. That's an interesting experience. I don't think I've heard of anybody being banned from Instagram. Is that because you exposed a lot of this stuff?
To run the business that I ran, it required a lot of testing. So a lot of the testing was done not necessarily on my personal account, but on what we called burner accounts. So I would link up with someone in Pakistan. They would give me a huge list of burner accounts. I would log into them and I would use those to test my system.
Ah.
Unfortunately, after some period of time, those accounts became very expensive to buy, let's say roughly a dollar each. So if you have 20 accounts banned in one day, then that's $20 and you have nothing to show for it. You don't even know if this guy in Pakistan is going to answer your next email. So to conserve things, yeah, I had a litany of my personal accounts that, including my main one, that I would sometimes use to test things as well, which had the effect of some of those accounts getting banned and specifically like getting a ban on my device or on my specific IP address as well. So there were tons of restrictions. I believe I still have my original personal account, but it's wiped. Like there's it's private and wiped, so there's like nothing there.
Wow. God, the world is changing. You're the perfect person to ask, I think, that you wrote your book. Did you utilize AI at all in writing your book? I'm asking for a specific reason, because a lot of people out there right now are feeling like, look, I know books don't make you money. Let me use some AI so I can accomplish the goal of at least being out there. What do you think about AI as it attaches itself to being an author?
I have written about this. One of my blog posts, I think, is called, "I Really Liked Your Book. Did you use AI?" And I see that as a snide comment because I view that as like not an authentic way to write a book. To answer your first question, I didn't use AI at all. I actually didn't use any writing tools, even like Grammarly. Like I didn't even use something that would help with more advanced like sentence structure or tone, anything like that. It was all basically like Google Docs, like very basic like spell check. And I make some points in that blog that I think you would enjoy reading about where I'm saying, where do we draw the line? Because at some point people probably said that having a Microsoft Word was unfair as well, and having spell check and grammar check and this and that. I think AI is a huge problem and it's been completely overblown. For me, as someone who has a computer science background, and I would like to think I write at a lower tier one level in that I find mistakes in newspapers. There's so much that AI can provide to humanity, but this type of like writing is not it. And at least at the current time, I can see through anything, even in terms of like how certain podcasts conduct business, how certain people send emails, certain people who post on LinkedIn, even now entire websites that are clearly written by AI. What this meant for Framed was it prodded me to publish the book as soon as I could. When I first saw the earlier OpenAI models, I sat down with my family over that holiday, whatever holiday it was, like 2 or 3 years ago, and we put in a bunch of prompts. And every prompt we said, write this as if you are Ernest Hemingway. And in every single one of the prompts, we were all blown away. And my family was in the publishing industry a very long time ago, like ancient history. And there was just this realization in the room that like it's over or it's coming to an end as far as good prose as well as good creative writing. So as someone who was trying to meld the two, I knew I needed to get the book out because when we see future models coming out, even by the end of this decade, a lot of writing, a lot of the things that are like worth publishing today will be outdone by AI. At least we can look at my book and see how much original research there is and say, no, AI couldn't have done that. You could look at certain aspects of the prose and be like, AI never would have done that. But one day that might be a different answer. And that deeply scares me.
It's scary. AI tools can be so valuable, and they certainly cut time. They can cut your commitment time to doing certain tasks. And it can be a lovely partnership, but you have to be really careful to how you work with it to maintain your own voice, because it can disappear so easily. All of it starts to look the same. You can tell immediately. And then your impression is of the person who sends it is, wow, you not only didn't make the commitment, but you're not even interesting. Anybody could have written this. At least that's what I think. And the worst
Sure.
is, people that are doing presentations, I say this to everybody listening on this show, I have seen some very interesting content go out there, but I'll tell you what AI can't do very well: spell. And it is amazing to me how much crap goes out there and it's misspelled. And people don't even need to take the time anymore to
Yeah.
make sure it's grammatically correct or that it's spelled right. That's death to me in a presentation. I'm used to fielding presentations in what I did for a living. And I look at it and I say, if you can't take the time to even use spell check to make sure things are spelled properly, I think you're sloppy. So I don't think you ought to be so reliant on AI. Here's my other question, just because this is coming up right now. AGI is going to really affect what's coming up for everybody, because it's now becoming sentient. It literally feels, talks. I just had this experience the other day. You know that movie, You're Too Young, but there was a movie, oh gosh, it must have been 20 years, called Her. Do you remember that with Joaquin Phoenix?
No,
Oh my
no.
God. All I can tell you is that's here now. That's actually here, what's happening in that movie, of being able to create a bot that literally communicates, has a relationship with you. I'm just wondering how that's going to play out in all the things that we're talking about.
It's very interesting because I would always joke with my friends that we had this specter of AI that was really popular. I would say starting in like 2013 and 2014. And AI back then didn't mean what it means today. AI back then meant like applied machine learning, which is really just advanced statistics. So, meaning if this happens, then this, if this happens, then that, if this happens, then that, which essentially, when we think about, generative, like these generative models for AI today, that's pretty much what it's doing, just at this hyper scale, and the training is very advanced. So all of this bothers me, and I think there is a more existential risk to white collar professionals and to a lot of the social relationships we talk about. I reference what I would say with my friends when we would poke fun at, oh, AI, it's just if else. The truth is that the bot that I built on Instagram was AI in that it could respond to some ambiguous prompts, to some ambiguous stimulus. So it's basically saying, hey, if this person liked me, it had a decision loop when it would decide, do I like them back? Do I comment on their thing? What do I do? So a lot of the things that we build as software engineers have artificial intelligence. It's just that this new stage where it's also generative and it's like very generalized, widely applicable, and then meshed with agents, some of which have there's like hardware and things in the physical world. Yeah, it's very scary. It's very scary. So I still use AI tools as a software engineer, but the implications for the humanity at large and like what this will lead to in terms of employment and the state of the nation, really, the state of society is quite scary.
It is. I think it is. I think there's very good reason to be nervous about it. And at the same time, I don't think it's going away. So we better figure out how to work through it. I think there will be some nefarious moves with this. At the same time, there are ways that it will be very beneficial. So we're in an interesting crossroads right now. It's going to take really intelligent people and hopefully some with some integrity, of which I'm awfully glad that you're on this show. Let me shift gears for a second into voice and influence and the power of standing in front of the room. You've really dissected the mechanics of influence in the world. But what happens when you're in the room and it's live and you're speaking face to face? How much do you value that? And I gotta tell you, I love it that you did all these podcasts and that you came on my show. I'm just thrilled. I know you set a goal of this many and no more. I'm so glad to be included in that group. It's delightful. But tell me what you think.
Thank you for that, Kelly, and it's a pleasure to be here. When I think about the difference between online influence and somebody's presence in person, it's very clear that these are two totally different things. In some cases, one leads to the other, but social media importance metrics cannot backfill real talent or real authenticity. And this is a case that I make over and over again in the book, which is that so many people who are proclaiming that they are musicians and professionals and writers and this and that and the other thing, sure, you might be able to showcase some things on social media. Sure, you can run an ad campaign just like anyone else. You can hire a PR agency to make yourself look better. You can buy fake followers. But if you're a violinist and you want to go play at Carnegie Hall, you have to practice and you have to accept that one day, the calling might be there. You might have a chance to audition and you might fail. And there's this pervasive, I would say, fear of failure, where so many people would rather scroll on social media all day, call themselves an influencer, have their little friends, and they all comment back. They all reciprocate each other's likes and follows and comments and whatever, but they never really do anything related to their craft. So the advice I give in Framed is that you should simply focus on your craft, because every person who purchased my service was doing something different. One of our first customers was a baker. We also had people who were like religious figures, which I don't entirely understand, like New Age prophets even, who were spreading the message. And what I would tell them is that if you're coming to me for advice on how to be the best prophet, or how to be the best baker, or how to be the best drummer, you're coming to the wrong person. All I can do is get you more followers on social media. You have to figure the rest out. And the ironic part is most people would come to social media growth services before they had even figured who they really are or what they were really good at. So this is something that I think is crazy. And the effect is that so much of what we see in real life just doesn't pair with the lives that people create, or the lies really that they peddle on social media.
Really, it breaks down to get real, get authentic, and get out there.
Absolutely. Just practice. Just put in the work. A lot of people don't, they want a shortcut for everything.
Were you always comfortable public speaking, considering your background? Was it easy for you to get on the stage? Was it an easy skill set for you to pick up?
For me, I've had a lot of experience speaking, especially to larger, like I would say medium-sized groups, even in college, where I was part of a fraternity. And people think of fraternities maybe in the stereotypical sense, but sometimes it means you also have to engage in real debates. And in front of 50 people with like money on the line or a budget on the line, you have to get up and make speeches. So for me, that was really the transformation of saying, I'm someone who has very strong opinions, and now I have to put my money where my mouth is. I have to stand up, and I can't be afraid to fail. And that helped me a lot with public speaking, not just in one-on-one interviews and podcasts, but also other types of other realms as well. I talk about it a little bit in my book, where you're even saying, how did who I was as this social media villain relate to my job performance when I had to give a speech at work, or I had a high stakes meeting at work? There's so much related to being a software engineer that is related to soft skills. There's a book, one of my favorite books ever written about software engineering, simply called Soft Skills. And it talks about a lot of these tactics, behaviors, principles that each individual should work on to be more effective in the workplace, and to be more effective in the personal space as well. But yeah, all of this came together in a unique way, and I'm glad that I don't have to either get on stage or go to a podcast and have to justify my presence by saying, okay, and I have 100,000 Instagram followers. I'm glad that I'm past that. I'm glad that I skipped it over entirely.
Wow. Is there, if I were to ask you, tell me right now what you are most proud of. You're still young, there's so much ahead of you. But at this very moment, if I said, what do you feel the most proud of that you've accomplished so far?
It would have to be putting the book out. It was a pursuit where nobody could actually hold me accountable. It was impossible. Like, the odds are just so difficult. The manuscript was 150,000 words, and this was crafted over a period of years where I had to sit down often and try to think about how someone else would perceive my work. And that's the hardest thing, is not just saying, okay, it's great, you're gonna love it. It's actually saying, oh, whoa, I don't think someone's going to like that. Or thinking, I need to read some other books. It was really this very deep, reflective period where I took a side hustle very seriously. And I think putting the book out there, getting it up to my standards, was a true accomplishment. And it's something that hung over my head for a few years. And now, being on the other side of it, I'm very proud.
I think your parents must be very proud of the person that you are and what you've created and how you look at life. I suspect that they must sit at the dinner table at night when you're not around and say, boy, we did this all right. We turned out a great human being. And in the end, that's the most important thing. I love what you've done. I have not had the privilege of reading your book, but I promise you, I now have it, and I'm very excited to be reading it, especially after we've met and I get to hear a little bit more about it. And your book, what a nice piece towards your legacy. It's very
Yeah,
cool.
I
So
appreciate you saying all that. Thank you.
it's awesome. And I just want to thank you so much, Tim, for dropping into this today. I am blessed. I am the last of his interviews before he moves on to the next adventure that's going on. And I'm so glad that our audience got to have the privilege of hearing your perspective. You totally flipped the script on this today. I feel like we got not only a lot of insight, but you handed us a decoder ring for the digital noise we're all drowning in. And I love that. I appreciate that. So I have a love-hate relationship with social media. So this was particularly appreciated by me. So thank you so much for coming to the show.
Thank you, Kelly.
You got such a sharp, unfiltered look at things. I love that you talk about that the system, it isn't just broken. It's functioning exactly as it was built to. And that may not be what we are going to want moving forward. We're going to have to make some new decisions, I think. I love it that you are for public speaking. Just by your being here, I can tell what a difference it makes to hear somebody speak about what they do. You really get a feel for who they are and who's behind those thoughts, who's behind the movements that they cause and what a difference they make. If you all out there want more of Tim's work, and of course you do, I do, go check out his website at tjohearn.com. And don't miss his book, Framed, A Villain's Perspective on Social Media. I just think that is such an intriguing title. It's available on Amazon. It's not your average how-to. It's part expose and part mind bender, I'm clear. And it's full of stuff you're not going to hear from the mainstream crowd. That makes for interesting content. And you really, Tim, you bring a voice to the mic that it doesn't just challenge the system, it exposes it. You know what? It's where public speaking becomes dangerous in the best possible way. It's how real ideas are spread. It's how real trust is built. It's how real leaders rise. And if this conversation made you think, please share it. This is one of those episodes that people should get to hear. If it made you squirm, definitely share it. We love hearing your thoughts and questions and rants and revelations. So don't be shy. Let us know. I love that. Like us, subscribe, of course, it helps. But I love to hear what you have to say about interesting conversations that we have. And this one has been particularly intriguing. We're here to show you how public speaking is incredibly powerful, not just for your revenue, not just for your reach, your reputation, your ability to cut through the noise, but it's because it makes a difference and how it matters. Thank you again, Tim. Not a dull conversation at all. I'd love to have you back again. I got to talk you into it. And we're going to need you. We're going to need you. And to everybody out there, I want to thank you for joining us. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation. See y'all next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.